Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's June 13th, 68 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. And we've got 66 degrees in Heber City. On the phone with us now from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Yeah, good morning, Utah. Things are shaping up to be another fantastic day, if you like the sunshine, of course. And these above-average temperatures are hanging on yet again with south flow in place. Along the Wasatch Front, we're potentially looking at record heat, 86 though for Park City, so maybe you'll have a lot of folks coming up to escape the hottest temperatures with those mid-80s again today. Overnight lows in the upper 50s. Now, Heber City also will be hot, especially for this time of year, and for their seasonal temperatures, 93 is expected in Heber. Partly cloudy skies still on Friday. Mentioned some moisture rotating through the state as a weak disturbance passes mainly through eastern Utah. It will provide some cloud cover, maybe take the edge off of some of these hotter temperatures. There's only still a 10% chance of an isolated shower or storm. The best chance for Park City will be later in the evening. Daytime highs will drop to 83 degrees in Park City and 89 in Heber. Sunny skies take over again for Father's Day weekend. Should be gorgeous. Temperatures in northern Utah, fortunately, will catch a little bit of a break. We've got cooler air moving in from the northwest, so we'll be in the upper 70s on Saturday, mid-70s for Father's Day. Overnight lows back into the upper 40s Sunday morning, and Heber will be back down into the mid-80s for highs on Sunday. Next week looks potentially even cooler. In fact, below average highs possibly by Tuesday will be about 70 degrees on Monday in Park City and 61 it's looking like right now on Tuesday, with a rebound towards middle of the week to near 70 degree highs. So maybe even getting a little bit cool considering how hot things have been. Heber will drop from the mid 80s on Sunday into the upper 70s on Monday, possibly the upper 60s Tuesday. Some of the models are still kind of back and forth on just how cool some of the weather will get early next week, so we'll keep monitoring that. Either way, it'll be a break from some of the high heat we're seeing now, and we could be back to 76 in Heber on Wednesday next week.
Okay, so we're talking cooler temperatures, but I didn't hear anything about rain.
I know, right? We need some moisture. They're all kind of dry systems moving through, so we could use some. Keep your hopes up.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Laura Anthony here with our trails report. Later on, Summit County Council Chair Melina Stevens recapping Wednesday's meeting. We'll also be talking with Park City resident Brooke Hans, now serving as Powder Mountain's new Chief Development and Construction Officer. She's just left the Extel Corporation that was developing the Mayflower or Deer Valley East Village. And Executive Director of Park City Saline, Scott Ramirez, with details on this year's saline season and some upcoming events. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include acclaimed physicist Sean Carroll, making the most complicated ideas in physics accessible for anyone who wants to learn. Then Charles Loheed explains how the intersection of technology and healthcare leads to happier, healthier, and more successful outcomes for both doctors and their patients. Stay tuned. And on the phone with us with our trails report, Laura Anthony with the Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy Thursday. Wasatch back. We've got Mia from Wasatch Trails Foundation reporting that there are no updates because everything in the Wasatch County trail system is up and running and looking good. Looks like we've got Dave from Basin Rec reporting in that all the basin trails are dry except for the upper Pinecone Trail, where kind of where you go into the pines there. There are big snow patches up there still, so maybe not a great day to do the pine cone loop quite yet. We're not there. Mid Mountain is currently cleared from King Road to the Alpine Lake that goes under the orange bubble, so they're all clear in that area. And it looks like we're gonna be looking at Rick's report from Mountain Trails. Looks like we've got a busy weekend at the Round Valley Quinn's Trailhead this weekend. We've got a lacrosse and hockey tournaments all weekend long. So maybe find a different place to launch on your ride or run or dog walk. Maybe Quinn's Junction. It's kind of hot out there anyway in Round Valley, so maybe hit something up on the mountain. We've got 400 miles of trails, so find something new and fun. It looks like the restoration work on Jenny's will have... Jenny's will be... Well, we're not closing the trail, but we do have an excavator out there, so just be super careful if you come up on the trail crew, let them know that you're there. Make sure you make eye contact and get a wave from the machine operator before you try to pass. Looks like we'll be doing work right around the Widowmaker run on Jenny's. And we've got reports here that all the trails in Park City Mountain are clear of blowdown. So we've been really going to town on that with the trail crew's been out there with saws and getting things cleared up. All the way up to the Shadow Lake Zone, Mid-Mountain is clear from Ontario Bypass to King Road. There's still large snowfields on the 9K and north-facing trails below that. Looks like we've got Lift Hall opening for Park City Mountain this weekend and for Deer Valley on Friday. So, yeah, it's going to be a great weekend to be out on the trails. Have a good one, and we'll see you out there.
Okay, Laura, thank you. On the phone with an update from yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have Council Chairwoman Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the CREA update. This is the formerly known as the Community Renewable Energy Agency, now known as the Utah Renewable Communities. Summit County is part of this initiative, and the idea was to go to net 100% renewable electricity countywide by 2030. The way that it's being presented is that this would be an option to customers in participating communities. So do individual customers have that choice?
So it would be an option available to individual customers to opt out of. And so it would allow to have cleaner energy within Summit County for us to be, you know, shifting to more sustainable pathways than coal.
So how do people opt out if they want to?
I believe there will be multiple notices that are sent to the customer that initially they can opt out if they choose to. And I believe that there is a pathway as the program continues that annually there's opportunities to be able to opt out.
All right. And this would be coming from Rocky Mountain Power, or what to look for?
It should be coming from Rocky Mountain Power, yes. But it's... We are still working on it. We're getting close, and that I would stay tuned for that timing as we get a little closer.
Sure. And if somebody remains in, what does that mean? I mean, would they see higher power costs?
I think that there's a slight increase. I don't remember it being dramatic from any numbers that I've seen in the past. A slight increase, but being able to contribute to our sustainability goals and helping to really lead the pathway both within the state as well as other areas of transitioning away from energy that is more harmful to the environment.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the county projected to grow in, you know, the next 5-10 years, I mean, is this program going to help eliminate any fossil fuel production?
My understanding is that because we are improving on infrastructure as well for solar, wind, et cetera, that there would be less of a need for coal into the future. Will some of the systems still be supplied using coal, you know, potentially, especially as we phase into that? But the idea is that we're moving away from the more harmful energy sources and really leaning into those that are sustainable for our community.
Okay. Moving on, Mountain Regional Water presented a proposal from the Lake Rockport Estates neighborhood, basically on the other side of Promontory. They're low on water, and they want to connect into the Mountain Regional System. All of the residents that were in attendance at yesterday's meeting say they support that idea. Does the council support it?
So with this particular subdivision, there are several on the east side of the county that were created as part-time cabin areas that were not intended to be full-time residents. Because of that, the water at the time, the water requirements were different. They were seasonal, first of all. So then these residents only receive water about half of the year. And then the wells dry up and they import their water for those that now live there full-time. Some of the hurdles that we're facing, they have a very antiquated water system. And it also is not built to the standards that would be necessary to have full-time water. So for instance, the pipes are very shallow. So in the wintertime, it's not feasible with the current system to, even if they had the water, to be able to pump it because the pipes are going to freeze because they're too shallow. With that, we as a council, we, you know, listen to Rocky Mountain to Mountain Regional, and their thought is, well, we need to really look into see if this is feasible. from what they've initially anticipated. It could be as much as, you know, if feasible and if everyone within that neighborhood decided to annex into Mountain Regional, which would be the necessary pathway, it could be as much as $300 a month more for those residents, just based on initial projections. I think right now we as a council landed that we're not opposed to this annexation. The challenge is going to be getting 100% approval from all of the residents, which is required by state statute in order for them to annex into this Mountain Regional system. I know, confusing all of them this morning, but into the Mountain Regional system. So we left it with go forth and see if you can get 100% participation from all of the landowners within that area. About just under half of the lots are not developed currently, and so it would need to be approved by them as well.
Sure. That estimated $300 more a month, is that just for water, or would that be to pay for upgraded infrastructure?
So again, it's just an estimate. My understanding from Andy yesterday was that would be for the bonding that would be necessary for the infrastructure. But again, an initial estimate, they would need to also, as part of this, do a feasibility study and also acquire easements through Promontory, Rockport Ranches, and redo some of the existing infrastructure to be able to pump water into this neighborhood. So that was, again, just an initial, I think, back of the napkin estimate as far as what that might look like. The feasibility study would be forthcoming depending on how many of the residents wanted to participate.
All right. Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas had recommended that the county should have 100% of the neighbors, including just lot owners, vote for annexation into Mountain Regional before proceeding. Is that a requirement, or is he just trying to stave off any sort of litigation? I mean, has the county seen previous litigation when trying to annex other communities?
So my understanding from our county attorney, Dave Thomas, is that by state statute, for a subdivision to annex into a special service district, there has to be 100% approval by all of the property owners within that area. So my understanding is that it's state statute. There is one other pathway. Essentially, the county could force an annexation, and then it would essentially need to be approved by 75%, or rather 25% of the residents would have to oppose it in order for it to not go through. And Dave Thomas did indicate that pathway has kind of been used once in the past. It was when the statute read a little differently, and that there was many, many issues, and ultimately that the county was allowed through specific legislation to de-annex that specific neighborhood because it was so problematic. So I think that was also something we as a county discussed was, well, with the health, safety, and welfare issue, perhaps we could go down this route. But that is something that if less than 100% of the residents approve of this annexation, that we would have another conversation as a council to really vet and determine if this is the best route forward for the county.
All right, moving on to the Toohey traffic. The council discussed that traffic on West 200 South near Camas. Residents say that the construction at Toohey is creating health and wellness concerns for them. The council sounds like it did favor closing the road with a crash gate. So why that instead of just paving it and putting some speed bumps in there?
So we looked at several options. Some of the concerns, we also did a traffic study over the course of, you know, 5 days. And with that, we saw that there was, you know, 2,600 vehicles that were using that road, 600 of which were construction vehicles. And there was, the high speed was 97 miles per hour. So with that, just in that short time period, also having had neighbors come to us on multiple occasions talking about concerns with the speed, with the dust, with overuse of the road, with people, construction vehicles coming very early, because construction vehicles, they can't start construction within Toohey until 7, but they're coming and just essentially sitting on the road, lining up, backed up on the road, waiting to be able to go into Toohey right at 7 a.m. to get started. And with that, the amount of enforcement that it would take to really make a difference on that specific road would be extremely costly to the county. I mean, we could pave it. That would essentially, I mean, that would likely create additional traffic because it would make road conditions better, would make it easier for construction vehicles to get through. Speed bumps with as heavy of a vehicles that are going through that neighborhood would likely not have a dramatic impact either. And so we really determined that the simplest, least costly way for us as a county to deal with this issue is just to simply put a crash gate. When Touhé and those neighborhoods were created, there Summit County was not included in that conversation. And so there's no agreement that we as a county need to absorb those impacts on that road for purposes of development in Touhé.
Yeah, members of the Touhé Homeowners Association were present at the meeting yesterday. Some unhappy with that crash gate idea, one grumbling that this would go to court. So does the county have the legal authority to put that gate up?
My understanding is that the county serves as the local highway authority and that through that avenue, we have the ability to be able to put a crash gate up on this road. Dave Thomas indicated that we couldn't make that decision yesterday, but would have to actually convene as the local highway authority, which we intend to do in our next meeting.
All right. And then did you speak to members of residents of Touhé before or after the discussion?
I know that some of the developers were notified as well as the residents in that neighborhood. Were members, all the residents of Touhé notified? I don't have the answer to that question.
Mm. And then, of course, we've got that gun club and a nature preserve where people recreate. Will that crash gate preserve access to those locations?
My understanding is that there would be foot access still through that. The reason that the crash gate would go where it is because it's essentially on the edge of the Summit County line. If we went any further, we would be into Wasatch County.
Yeah, and the Wasatch County Council has noted how West 200 South is the primary entrance for development there called Wakara. They were absent from the discussion yesterday, so will this crash gate affect access to that development?
I mean, this crash gate is serving as back of house, essentially an emergency exit for that neighborhood. The construction vehicles still have the opportunity to go in the front doors like everyone else to be able to do the construction that they need to do. So we haven't prohibited access for these vehicles to go through there. We've just limited access through the areas of Summit County that they would need to go. They can still go in the front doors to both of these developments and get the work done.
Okay. Let's see, the University of Utah, the Behavioral Health Executive Committee, which you sit on, has renegotiated a contract with the University of Utah for mental and behavioral health services in the county. I guess first maybe just explain, what is this program? I mean, who are we serving here?
So this program is serving essentially all of our clientele within the county that encompass drug courts, interact with our courts, school-based services. These programs that are really essential to the functioning of both, I would say both our criminal justice system, as well as behavioral health for some of the most vulnerable members of our community, including our children. And this contract is actually an extension of the current contract is what we approved yesterday in order to give some additional time for the ongoing contract negotiations with both Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the University of Utah Behavioral about the ultimate, you know, 3-5 year contract that will be put into place over the next few months.
Yeah. So do you have a sense for how many county residents participate in programs provided by this contract?
So within our system, both the Medicaid component of our system, as well as the state component, which this contract is covering the state monies, I believe it's somewhere about 4,000 people are taking advantage of our system currently with that money, which is pretty significant with the numbers that we had previously that were in the hundreds. Our system has expanded pretty tremendously. And as someone who has worked in and around behavioral health for most of my career, I think it's really exceptional that we as a county have prioritized behavioral health, that we are offering services both private pay as well as having options for members of our community that don't have the ability to pay, to have discounted rates. Also want to honor all of those those organizations that have sliding scales and that are serving people that are not able to take advantage of Medicaid or state systems, because it's really critical. We saw that through COVID. We've seen that multiple times within our community when we've had tragedies, that really taking care of our behavioral health and just the mental wellness of our community is pretty paramount.
All right. As you mentioned, the contract was approved and it extends the current contract for 6 months at a higher price. So this used to cost the county $300,000 a year. The contract has Summit County paying more than that for the last 6 months of the contract. What happens after the contract expires again?
So the $300,000 a year that you mentioned, Leslie, is the match that we're required to pay for Medicaid, which is separate from this specific contract. Part of the issue and why negotiations have been ongoing for just about a year regarding this contract is because there's been a shortfall within the University of Utah system that has essentially been subsidizing the Summit County program for the last several years. And so as they've dug into their numbers, as we have looked into our system and what is happening there, it's really become apparent that there has to be additional contribution to continue our system the way that we have it and to be able to serve all of those individuals. So this, the additional money that is required through the extension of the contract, which is written as a monthly, essentially monthly contract, so it can be canceled, you know, within 30 days by either party. And we anticipate that we will not extend it throughout the duration of the 6 months, that was likely 2 or 3 months of the extension that will be needed before we're able to get the next contract into place, but that we are able to extend that, serve our community, and that the University of Utah is breaking even instead of subsidizing our system.
Okay, finally, I just wanted to make a note of it. I will be bringing on the new first full-time director of the North Summit Recreation District, J.C. Diston, on Monday. The council went ahead as and approved her employment contract. So is this just the first of many more hires to come for that recreation district?
You know, right now, this is the first full-time employee that North Summit Recreation Special Service District has ever had. They've had a part-time executive director in the past. And having a full-time director, they really determined that in order to take the organization to the next level, to have the time and attention on that, especially given that there are projects that they're currently working on in Colville that have been time intensive, pretty extensive, there's desire from the community to enhance the programming as well. And that really required a full-time person. So we're thrilled that JC is coming on full-time, that really can take that district and move it forward. As far as additional hires, I would anticipate into the future that there would need to be additional hires, but that's not something that's being contemplated right now, or something that I think has been looked at all. It's really, let's get this employee, this director in place so that we can determine how to move forward into the future. Okay. Right now, there's simply not the budget for that.
All right. Malene, anything else you wanted to add?
Just really wanted to thank all of the residents and community members that came to our meetings yesterday. We had several items that I know people were paying attention to, really appreciated both the input before and conversations that I know took place afterwards, as well as the staff.
All right. Appreciate your time, Malena. Thank you.
Thank you.
Malena Stevens is the chairwoman of the Summit County Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, on Tuesday, the chair of MIDA, that's the Military Installation Development Authority Board of Directors, Senator Stuart Adams honored Park City resident and the former vice president of development for Extel Development Company, Brooke Hans, for her work on that MIDA development project in Wasatch County. Hans has served with Extel, the developer of the Mayflower, now known as the Deer Valley East Village Development, since February of 2015. And she recently resigned to accept a new position with Powder Mountain. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So congratulations on that award. Nice to be honored.
Thank you. It was, yes.
Yeah. So while you were an employee of Extel, Who calls the shots out there? Is it MIDA or is it Extel? Or is it just really a big collaboration?
Wouldn't that have been nice if it had been Extel? No, the MIDA calls the shots, but prior to that, really, Wasatch County called the shots, and that collaboration continues today, even under MIDA. And so I think that's an important distinction that the All of the work that I actually did for Extel originally was done with Wasatch County and then adopted by MIDA, and MIDA and Wasatch County continue that relationship in partnership.
All right, so just a bit about your background. You have owned a planning consulting business, Daily Summit Consulting, for years. You also served on the Park City Planning Commission. One term, two terms?
One long term. How's that?
You extended it until they've got somebody?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And then prior to Extel, you were with the Jack Johnson Company for 9 years. Can you talk just briefly about how different is that job with Extel from what you did with Jack Johnson or your private business? I mean, is it different just working with a company that, again, has it part of this project area? Just something that we don't understand, I don't think.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question, because I think one of the things that's different is when you work in consulting, and particularly at Jack Johnson, I worked for the owners, right? And so you're in a different relationship with how the ownership makes decisions and how close you are to those. And then you're kind of in the middle between the decision makers, whether they're the government or the ownership of the company. And then when you work for a company like Extel, you're representing the actual, you are the owner, right? And so you get to make decisions closer to the checkbook and you get to somewhat own those decisions. And so we utilized a lot of consultants, hundreds, frankly, at Extel that were very important to us, that furthered the work and that, you know, basically allowed us to achieve what we were able to do.
Yeah. So in the kind of the verbiage of the award on Tuesday, it noted that you were vital in facilitating the eventual funding and construction of that new military facility to replace the old Air Force lodge there at Snow Basin. And funding of the Extel project has always fascinated me. I mean, it's like this huge redevelopment agency kind of turning blight into multi-million dollar development. So, I guess that's why I kind of wanted to bring up how you worked for Jack Johnson and then with Extel, because how different is this type of financing from the traditional fundraising that a developer would have to do? I mean, most of those folks have had to raise money privately.
They do, but frankly, you know, developers all over the country and people I worked with when I was at Jack's were looking for these types of mechanisms and in terms of tax increment financing. And they're not necessarily available everywhere, but they are becoming more and more popular throughout the country because of places that lack certain economic development characteristics, whether it's because, to your point, of blight, or just basically things haven't happened there because they're too rural, or there are certain aspects of a project, maybe like an environmental consideration, that needs a little more attention in order for it to be successful.
All right. And I'm going to kind of pull that back when we make the move into the Powder Mountain development. But I guess as you walk away from Extel, maybe just talk a little bit about some of your proudest accomplishments there. I know, of course, you're an outdoor enthusiast and real proud of the trail system you put together.
Absolutely. So that was key because for years, you know, this August is year 29 for me here in Park City. And so the landscape between Park City and Wasatch County, there have always historically been very few physical connections, hiking and biking, that were actually legal. You know, if you did them, you were trespassing. And so the Mayflower piece and all of the pieces we were able to assimilate into that property, including the Pioche over by Deercrest, now make this fantastic interconnection that you can do a variety of ways, loops, out and backs that never existed before. And so that, you know, 50 minimum miles of trail system, I'm quite proud of. Obviously, that then translates into the 45th Star Conservation Preserve, the 3,100 plus acres of forever preserved land that absolutely wouldn't have happened without the, you know, multiple parties working together in order to bring that to fruition. And also the, you know, the things that people don't want to talk about because they're a little bit hard to understand is the environmental cleanup. And so there were over $15 million spent to clean up the remnants of someone else's digging around in the dirt up there. And that was never going to go away. And so unlike Park City, where you look around and, you know, we've got, you can see remnants of people in the silver mining history here. that have been just left here. We went in instead with Extel and cleaned that all up so that the property is in a much better condition and is forever cleaned up and part of the voluntary cleanup program.
So you feel confident, though, because all of what we've just heard, a lot of that, most of the workforce housing is going on the site of that former cleanup site.
It's actually going adjacent to it because that is actually a separate cleanup. We did a significant cleanup on the west side of the highway, and then on the east side of the highway there are some remnants that, you're right, that had been assembled or left in place and then capped, and then we acquired the land adjacent to that last year, when I was with Extel, and so that land is not impacted necessarily by the adjacent capped areas, but that happens also all over the country, and fortunate to be able to have that land.
Yeah. So was your job with Extel done, or you just saw this other opportunity with Powder Mountain?
No, my job wasn't done, but it really felt like after the work with Alterra and Deer Valley to accomplish the lease, and then to in the same month to take down the conservation easement, it felt like a huge culmination and, you know, kind of legacy building. And so it was just the timing ended up being right, though, when Powder Mountain called.
Okay, so as I mentioned, you have taken a position with Powder Mountain as the chief development officer. And we've seen this resort go through a few iterations. At one point, your colleague at Jack Johnson's office, Craig Elliott, was working with the owners of Powder Mountain. That really just kind of went nowhere. But step in Reed Hastings, the co-founder of Netflix, and with him $100 million. And that's where I guess it was like, this guy's coming with cold hard cash. He doesn't need to go through these PIDs or DIDs or, you know, any of this tax increment financing.
Well, although I would highly recommend that to Reed, he has a different take on how he wants to move forward with this resort. I won't say that we won't potentially be looking at other ways of financing, but he's come in with a different perspective, and this is a very exciting to be part of a new team at Powder Mountain that is focused on bringing some master plans that have somewhat been kicked around for, I would say, at least 20 years to fruition.
So talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, we have heard that there's a plan to basically make this another Yellowstone Club or Wasatch Mountain Resort, something that would be private. But will it still allow public access?
Absolutely. And so it is a completely different model, although there are similarities to private skiing. So at least a significant portion, and frankly larger than the expansion I just did with Deer Valley East Village, of skiing will be available at Powder Mountain to the public. And that skiing is in areas that is currently not in bounds, and will include some of, like, if you're a Powder Mountain lover, you're going to still be able to ski some of the lifts that you're familiar with, although they will be upgraded. And so then in addition, we're adding terrain that hasn't necessarily been traditionally skied, and certainly not by lifts, that will be eventually turned into private terrain. And so in my mind, it's the best of both worlds. You've got this element and ability, if you so desire, to buy into the club and real estate and take part in the private skiing, or you can ski the very large, one of the largest in the country's ski resort that's available and open to the public.
Yeah, so what kind of development approvals are needed? I mean, is there any vesting in this at all? And who do they get it from?
I've had, fortunately, throughout my career, I've been able to work with different ownership of Powder Mountain. So back in 2001, I actually wrote the zoning while at Jack Johnson Company for both Weber County and Cache County, because the ski resort existed. It had existed for over 20-some years at that point on both counties, yet the zoning wasn't aligned with the uses that they had in place. So that was done early in the 2000s. And then the master plans, I also was able to work on and convert into approvals in both counties in the mid-2000s. So those documents exist. Weber County is kind of slightly more progressed in terms of development actually happening there, some subdivisions established, and the development rights essentially tied up in a development agreement. Cache County, we have some work to do. Although we did do a master plan, we're going to regenerate those efforts and start discussions with them very soon to make that those approvals also perfected.
So best case scenario, when would development start?
Well, we are currently installing two new lifts, if you want to consider that development, I do, this summer, with hopefully four going in. We're still in conversations at the end of this month with Cache County to make sure that those can go in this summer. And then next summer, you'll see a lot more activity. We intend to install more lifts, again, if permitting goes well. You'll see some foundations and work being done on residential units and a clubhouse.
So are we talking new lifts or replacement?
Both. So the two that are going right now are new replacement lifts. And then the two that we hope to start installing later this summer are brand new lifts in new locations.
All right. And then when you think about the residential component of it, I mean, we're talking new lodges at the, I think there's a couple bases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So new lodges there, and then also the residential development at the base, or are we talking spread throughout the mountain, more like kind of the Bald Eagle?
Right. So Powder Mountain, if you haven't been there, it's most people call it an upside down mountain. And so everything's at the top. So you have to drive or take a shuttle or share ride share up to the top of the mountain. And then essentially all of the base facilities are there, and they are located currently in three different relatively flat places at the top of the mountain. And so all of the work you're going to see in terms of upgrades is going to take place up there.
Hmm. And then you've got water you need and things like that? I mean, the
yes,
basics?
Yes. All of those things exist. And as we grow, they will continue to need to be expanded and upgraded. But fortunately, you know, Dr. Kobe had the foresight to get a lot of things in place, including a water and sewer district back nearly 50 years ago.
Yeah. So kind of walking from Extel then to Powder Mountain, I mean, what do you think you can bring from Extel to Powder Mountain?
The past near decade of time I spent with Extel and within the MRF, the MIDA project area, there pretty much wasn't anything related to development I didn't do. So that was it created a vast amount of knowledge and experience, even if it was just on a light touch level, that I hopefully will translate very easily over to Powder Mountain Resort.
Yeah. So do you anticipate MIDA having a look at Powder Mountain?
We have not been in conversation. That wasn't an intention to talk to MIDA about that. Although we do hope to have a great relationship, as Hill Air Force Base is just down the hill. So it's a really convenient and easy access for skiing for those people at Hill.
Yeah, not so much for you, so you don't have to make the haul up there every day, do you?
I don't go every day, but I am going quite often.
Oh, putting some miles on.
Yes.
Okay, Brooke, anything else you think is worth noting?
No, I'm excited to my new venture, and I hope that I get to see a lot of Park City folks making the trek and trying something new. When I mention I'm at Powder Mountain, people think they know, and come to find out that they haven't been yet. And so, yes, it's the mountain north of Snow Basin, and so we hope to see you there.
Okay. Brooke, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Congratulations. In the studio now with an update from Park City Sailing, I have Executive Director Scott Ramirez. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so just maybe start by telling us a little bit about Park City Sailing. I know it was started a while ago. It seems like by folks who maybe grew up on the coast and wanted to bring sailing to Park City.
Yeah, that's accurate. Park City Sailing has been around since about 2008. It's evolved a lot since then. We are a 501c3. And it evolved from a racing club to an organization that offers education, adaptive sailing. We have a thriving junior sailing program. It allows members, families, people of all ages to learn how to sail or just go out sailing and be independent about it, as well as to have a social circle. And we also have a thriving race program still.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about how it works, because you mentioned members. You do have to be a member?
We are a very inclusive program. We welcome anyone to come join us. We encourage membership, although it's not required to come and participate in education. We encourage membership for a number of reasons. I mean, it's It's a way to pay your dues and show your support, but it also is a way to get discounts on education, although you don't need to be a member to come take classes. We do appreciate people's show of support by joining and continuing to be members, though.
Okay, so are there different membership levels, or is it just kind of a flat fee each year?
There are not. You can join as an individual, and we also offer family memberships for the same price.
Oh, okay. And then again, that gets you access then to boat rental at a reduced price and some of the courses?
Correct. So being a member would be your first step if you wanted to join our access program, which allows you to use some of our boats on your own. It also gives you a discount on junior sailing camp or lessons.
Okay. And you just don't let people go out. You require them to know what they're doing?
That's correct. Yeah. I also want to mention your membership is required to be part of the race program, too. But no, we make sure that someone passes a skipper's check in order to operate a boat. So you have to prove that you have the skills and wherewithal.
All right. So talk a little bit about then some of the classes that you have. I mean, you've got to have a bunch of instructors then to do all of this?
Absolutely, yeah. So we have two programs. We have our junior sailing program, and we have an adult sailing program, which also includes our outreach program. The junior sailing program is our bread and butter in terms of participation. We have upwards of 500 kids a season out there. We do week-long camps. So that's 500 across the entire season. We have a fantastic team of instructors. I'm very, very proud and grateful for all of them, and a junior sailing director to run that program. We have kids anywhere from ages 5 to 17. We have learned to sail through intermediate all the way to a very successful racing team that has been traveling to some regattas, and really excited to see that progression. And then our adult sailing program, we have another director who runs that program. We have group lessons and private lessons, as well as visiting camps that come. We work with the NAC, other community partners that come and do adaptive and therapeutic sailing. We like to call it socially impactful sailing. So there's just so many benefits to sailing, and we try to invite as many people from the community, whether it's a family or an entire group, to come out and sail with us. And we do corporate experiences as well.
Oh, awesome. So people can get all of this information, website?
Yes, sailpc.org. It's, there's a lot of information there. And then we are good at answering questions at info@sailpc.org.
Okay, and all of this happening at the Jordanelle there at the main beach?
Yeah, so we operate at the personal watercraft ramp at the Jordanelle State Park. We are very grateful for our involvement within the state park. We have a great relationship. It's a beautiful venue. Mountain sailing can sometimes be a little bit inconsistent depending on where you are in the mountains. For us, we have a really consistent southerly breeze. We rely on thermals. In the evenings, we'll get a northerly breeze that sort of comes down through our little cove there from Deer Valley. But we get really good wind for being in the mountains, and we have a beautiful place to sail.
Yeah. How many boats do you guys own?
That's an interesting question. So let's just say this. If you came down to the lake to look around, you could see maybe 100 boats. But some of them are very small. Some are on dollies in a yard. Some are out on moorings. Some are on racks. We have 6 J-22s, a 22-foot keel boat. That belong to the organization. We have a few others that belong to some members that are part of our race program. We have three different types of junior sailing boats. Gosh, I don't know, like 40 of them. And then we have a lot of safety boats for coaching and transporting people to and around and to just for coaching and following people around the water.
Yeah, those 22 foot. I mean, how many people does it take to sail one of those?
Anywhere from 1 to 4, you know, ideally 2 or 3 is a good size crew for that boat.
All right. And
it's
then
great for a family too.
Yeah. And then you just have like the smaller boats that one person can go out and.
Yeah. So we race lasers. It's an Olympic class one design boat. It's a small boat. It's a wet boat experience. So you might be tipping over, especially when you're learning. Those are privately owned boats. A few belong to the organization. We race those on Tuesdays. They're really fun to watch. It's an athletic boat with a pretty large sail for how small the boat is. And then the kids are sailing in boats called prams and RS Terras and 420s. And those are all small boats. And so a dinghy is a type of boat that has a centerboard underneath, but it can still tip over. A keel boat is a type of boat not meant to capsize because the hull of the boat has a fixed keel with a lead core. And so the boat will lean over, but it doesn't flip over. So the difference between a keel boat and a dinghy is kind of an important distinction to make. And we've got both of those.
Okay. Talk to us a little bit about that, the sailing program, because the junior sailing program, you just have that. You also have the kids that compete.
Yeah, so our junior sailing program, we have the biggest staff team we've ever had this year. I'm really, really happy about that. Programs from ages 5 to 17, beginner through intermediate, competitive race team. So the junior race team actually just went to a North American championship and took podiums in Alamitos Bay, California. Really proud of that. They've actually been traveling with their coach, Coach of the Year, Christian Coolis, got to put in that plug, to a lot of regattas on the East and West Coast. And they're also traveling to some events during the winter. So it's just really awesome to see that progression over these years. We've developed an organization where now these junior sailors are also becoming instructors too. And so to see that progression is awesome because there's many directions you can go with sailing. The pathways of sailing can lead to cruising and adventure sailing or to racing. And it kind of just depends on the person, but we've seen a lot going on there and it's so exciting.
Okay. You do still have some spots open in your week-long camps?
We do. Yeah. We're welcoming signups, kids of all ages. People are always surprised to hear that we can have kids between 5 and 7 years old in our Guppies program. We've got room there. We put those kids together on a keelboat with an instructor. And then once you progress a little bit further or you're a little bit older, we also do learn to sail where you are with a partner in a small boat or depending on your age, you might just start out alone. And then, yeah, it just progresses. The older you are, the larger or taller you are, you might be in a larger boat. And that just kind of progresses through how, you know, the amount of work that you want to put into it and time spent.
Okay. And you've also got an opportunity for people to come learn a lot more at your, you call it the Sailstice event?
Yeah. So this weekend we are hosting an event called Summer Sailstice. It's actually a global celebration of sailing that people host at their different clubs or venues around the world. We are doing ours this weekend. And the weather is looking great, and we want to invite anyone from the community to come out and join us. It's a great opportunity just to learn about all things Park City sailing. It's an open house event with boat demos, sailing rides for all ages, barbecue games, live music between 2 and 3. And it's just a great way to just to come see the venue, see the boats, see all these things that I'm talking about that may sound abstract to some people, meet our staff, meet other board members, and meet other members.
Okay. Anything else you want to let people know?
Yeah, absolutely. I get so passionate. I think we all are about the benefits of sailing and what makes Park City Sailing so special. So to have this venue just 10 minutes outside of town and to have a thriving sailing program in a ski town is huge. And we're really proud of it. The benefits of sailing for all ages are immense. And, you know, for a kid to sail solo with a partner, to be learning geometry, mechanics, and physics is powerful stuff. And showing people that the mind matters more than brute strength is really valuable for kids. Size and gender are irrelevant to success. And the lessons that we learn from nature about life being ever dynamic is something that we really want to share with everyone. And it's something we just want to be very inclusive and welcoming for the community to come enjoy this.
Okay. Hey, Scott, thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Scott Vermeeris again with the Park City Sailing Association. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the historic Echo Church is open every Saturday this summer and will be hosting the traveling exhibition, Chugging, Screeching, Rumbling, Billowing, Utah's Industrial Revolution. This Saturday, a lecture featuring this part of Utah's history will follow the exhibit's opening. It's all in Echo, Utah, which is no longer the thriving summit community it used to be in the mid-1800s when Echo served as one of the stops along the Mormon Trail, later becoming a junction when the first transcontinental railroad was joined in 1869. After the interstates were built, the town slowly faded. Today, the population about 50. Today, there's not just the Echo Historic Church left in Echo. There are still a few dozen homes, an old two-room schoolhouse, and a post office still in operation. Through some grants, including the Summit County Wrap Fund, the Echo Church will be open every Saturday this summer through Labor Day from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And this Saturday, Dr. Chris Merritt, the Utah Historic Preservation Officer, will discuss what he found at an archaeological dig in Terrace, Utah. This is a place that once housed a large population of Chinese workers who helped build the rail line. Terrace is about 40 miles west of the Golden Spike Historical Park, in the very northwestern corner of the state. Merritt says that Terrace existed between the completion of the railroad and the early 1900s when the town all but disappeared.
After the railroad abandoned the town, it was fully turned into a ghost town within months. And that left today a very rich archaeological history that was still on the ground from old foundations and the artifacts of the people that lived in the community. the town of Terrace was also the third largest concentration of Chinese in Utah Territory in the 1870s. And so it's an interesting glimpse into understanding the lives of that immigrant group.
This is the first time in the U.S. that archaeologists have fully uncovered a Chinese home from that transcontinental railroad area.
Archaeology is such a powerful tool to really understand the daily lives of those in the past. History, whether books or newspapers, can give us a lot of events, names, dates, but archaeology, when it's paired with history, can make that history much richer by giving those personal objects, those personal artifacts. And as archaeologists, we uncovered over 3,800 artifacts from this home.
Artifacts uncovered included tableware porcelains and stoneware jars, even organic materials like fish vertebrae, a coconut shell, and a braid of human hair.
That's why archaeology is so important, is that it removes a lot of the biases, because in history, you know, people wanted to depict themselves in a certain way. But a famous anthropologist always said, we never lie to our trash pile.
His free lecture Saturday begins at 4 o'clock. It'll last about an hour. The historic Echo Church located off of I-80 at exit 169.